Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies. I am Jeannie Lee from the University of Arizona. Today, we're joined by Dr. John Marotto and his new book, Japanese Philosophy in the Making, Volume 2. This book was published by Chisokudo Publications this year. The first volume was published in 2017, and the third volume is scheduled to come out soon. Dr. Marotto is a professor of Japanese philosophy at the University of North Florida. This volume is a collection of essays by Dr. Marotto on Japanese philosophy in the early 20th century, with a particular focus on three important figures, Watsuji Tetsuro, Tanabe Hajime, and Kuki Shuzo. These essays also reflect on how these intellectuals' ideas responded to the search of modernity around this time in Japan. So welcome, Dr. Marotto. Thank you so much for joining us today on the New Books Network.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here and have this conversation. And I love the New Books Network and the way that it is really a great venue for introducing academic work, in this case on Japan.
Thank you so much for your support of our network. So you have written a lot on Japanese philosophy. What specific aspects do you focus on, and why do these aspects interest you?
Yes, well, there are a lot of different aspects that I have focused on, and so let me just mention three to begin with. First of all, is the language of the philosophers, in particular, I mean the terminology, the concepts that they use, and often those concepts that are a synthesis of adapted European concepts and East Asian concepts, and then they're often their own creations, their own neologisms. So I've been very interested in the way that specific languages, in this case Japanese, shape the issues that philosophers discuss. Maybe I could just give an example of that. So, when philosophy as a discipline was first introduced into Japan, basically starting the 1870s, there were some times earlier than that, starting the 1550s, when say Jesuits would come to Japan and teach philosophy in their own institutes and academies. But that's basically limited, extremely limited. So the huge influx of contemporary philosophical language came starting, say, the 1870s. And And so I was very fascinated by the huge, we could call it the huge trove of nouns, of new compounds in Chinese characters that were introduced. Bill LaFleur once said that what the Japanese brought back from Europe were thousands and thousands of nouns. Typical words such as the word for philosophy, tetsugaku, which are new to the Japanese language. And we tend to forget about this today. Even people teaching, learning philosophy in Japan tend to forget how new some of these words and their concepts are. So, for example, there's the old word, or actually a new word for individual, kojin. Okay, now this word, I don't know exactly how old this compound is, consisting of two Chinese characters, two sinograms, but this kojin was used to translate the English word individual, or its European counterparts, right? But it's a very interesting kind of compound because the ko of kojin actually is a counter. So it is a word which lets us select or pick out a member of a group, and the word individual that was being translated in the European languages rather referred to something that was totally unique, something that could stand alone, something that was more or less self-sufficient. So today, of course, the word kojin in Japanese can mean that as well. But originally, the intellectuals in starting this 1870s struggled with words like individual to try to convey as best they could some of the European ideas. So this is an example of, say, how new words entered the Japanese language and really revolutionized their thinking in a way that we today tend to forget about. It becomes invisible with the usual use of language today. So that's just one example of, say, the way that a specific language has been altered to let people see in a new way, and think in a new way, and behave in a new way. The emphasis on individuality has become in some people's minds quite extreme in Japan. So that, for example, the last time I lived in Japan, the TV advertisements were talking about things like my car, my car, or my this, or my that. Again, focusing on us as standing alone individuals. So that's just one example of one of the aspects that I've been interested in. I said that there were three. So another one is what we could call the internal logic of the philosophers I've been studying. Very rarely do they think and write in a kind of what we could call straight line fashion. So one has to be able to go along with for maybe pages before one understands actually what is going on, what is being said. Of course, this occurs in philosophy in the English language as well. But I would say for people coming from the outside to the Japanese language, it takes quite a bit of rethinking of effort. So how philosophers think differently, and because they are thinking in a different language. In the case of Japan, though, we have to remember that this different language is already it's a kind of multicultural language, because philosophical language in Japan was shaped by European concepts for the past 150 years. And then this is something perhaps we could get back to later, but a third aspect I've been interested in, is intrigued with really, is the connection between some of these philosophers and Zen Buddhism and also other forms of Buddhism. So that's a big topic in itself, and perhaps we could return to that later.
Yes, I definitely want to revisit this topic later. The current dissertation chapter that I'm writing tries to bring up this question, and it's been quite difficult. But to go to the first book of this series, which was published in 2017, so that entire volume is dedicated to this philosopher called Nishida Kitano. So you provided some translations of his works, and you provided some interpretations and context of these writings. Who is this person, and why is he so important in Japanese philosophy? What are some of his most important ideas?
Right. So Nishida Kitaro was, he lived from 1870 to 1945, and he became known as a Zen philosopher, which I find is only one way to depict him. But it happens to be the way that that first intrigued me as well. So Nishida is by far the most important and the most famous 20th century philosopher in Japan. And it's even been said by a more contemporary philosopher that philosophy in Japan necessarily goes through and perhaps succeeds or goes out of or rejects Nishida, but it doesn't get by without him. So let me tell the story actually of how I first became interested in Nishida and in Japanese philosophy in general. This is not what I was studying in graduate school. I was studying in Munich, Germany, and I was studying German philosophy and what's called hermeneutics, the theories of interpretation and understanding. And I was studying mainly contemporary figures like Martin Heidegger, who also was influenced very deeply by Chinese and Japanese thinkers. But so I was, you know, I had my head deeply into these texts and conversations about them. And then some American junior year abroad students came to Munich, and they said, you should read D.T. Suzuki about Zen Buddhism, and you should read Eugen Herigel's book, Zen in the Way of Archery, and read the poet Basho and his haiku. These were totally new things to me. I had little, if any, contact with Zen Buddhism or any of this matter, which all of our listeners today will be familiar with. And I realize, of course, that people like D.T. Suzuki and Eugen Herigel have become the objects of rather harsh criticism since those days. But it's ironic that so many of us did first enter into Japanese studies through figures like this, the great popularizers. So D.T. Suzuki wrote a preface to the major work, the most famous work of Nishida Kitaro. And in that preface, D.T. Suzuki identifies Nishida as the Zen philosopher par excellence. He's so much more than that, but he is that also because of his lifelong experience. He started out studying actually European philosopher when he was in high school, when he was learning to read English and German. And many of his entries in his diary actually are written in German. And so he was becoming aware, as were students in the higher schools all over Japan, of European ideas. It was a very revolutionary time. Shortly after that, D.T. Suzuki got, or actually it was their mathematics teacher at the fourth higher school in Ishikawa-ken, who got Suzuki and Nishida both interested in Zen Buddhism. And so they both began to practice in monasteries around Kamakura in their early 20s. And Nishida did this for about a decade. And so because I became first interested in these alternative views of Buddhism, and especially Zen, I looked naturally to a Zen philosopher, and that's where Nishida came into the picture. So he is he's indispensable if you look at philosophy in Japan. He himself is what I think of as a kind of intercultural philosopher, because he draws so much from European traditions, and he churns them around and he comes up with new and startling, innovative ideas himself, which let people understand not only Western philosophy differently, but also East Asian philosophies in Zen Buddhism differently. I could give some examples. So Nishida's most famous idea is actually a concept that he borrows from the Europeans and from the American William James. And that's this idea of pure experience. It's the most famous one in Nishida. And do you know, it's also the most short-lived idea in his philosophy itself. But it caught on. So what is this? What exactly is this pure experience? An example. This morning here, it was really quite cold. And stepping outside, the cold was all over my skin. And at the same time, it was very sunny, and I could see the yellow leaves glistening all around. And then I began to reflect. Philosophers have a terrible habit of reflecting on everything, but I began to reflect on this. And of course, then I think such things as, oh, I was cold, and I saw the yellow leaves on the ground. Pure experience is that momentary phase before we split our experience into somebody who's experiencing the subject and something outside that is being experienced, the object. So Nishida called that pure experience, using this expression he borrowed, actually. And so he saw that as a basis for understanding everything in the world, and he modified that idea. He turned it around and changed it, and changed the language, and came up with new concepts. But his beginning, at least, is what at that time was called pure experience. Later on, I'm just going to pick out a couple of other innovations that Nishida made. Pure experience was really not an innovation, and it shouldn't have been. It should name something which is accessible to anybody. You don't have to have a philosopher to come out and tell you that experience has these initial phases. But a more innovative concept he came up with is has a technical term. It's a little bit difficult, but in Japanese, it's koi teki chokkan. And this is translated, chokkan is intuition, and koi, of course, is action. So actional intuition or inactive intuition or performative intuition. Now, this sounds very hard to grasp, but the idea is simple. The idea is something about how we think with our bodies, how we think through, how we see through bodily action with things, through interactions with other people and with things. So again, instead of a usual conception that tells us we humans have minds which open us to objects in the world, Nishida's conception was that first we are engaged with things in the world through our activities, through our actions, and those help us see, those let us see what is going on. So it's embodied from the very beginning. And this again is for Nishida, an origin of knowledge, of scientific knowledge, of social knowledge. And it's very different because it's an engaged knowledge, which is it doesn't buy into the ideals that knowledge is supposed to be objective and disinterested and disengaged from our own experiences. So today, what Nishida was talking about in the past 20, 30 years has been developed by psychologists and other philosophers. Some don't know the name Nishida at all. And it's called the theory of inaction, E-N-A-C-T-I-O-N. So inaction is a theory that first comes up, I think, in Nishida's writing. And let's see. Well, let's leave it at that, and we'll see what else we can say later about Nishida.
That's absolutely fascinating. And I mean, well, when I first read about it, it was a bit hard to comprehend. But I guess we also need to talk about the historical context or the intellectual context of this time when, as you mentioned, Japanese philosophers were heavily influenced by European philosophy. So why were they so drawn to European philosophy at this time? Why did aspects of, say, philosophers like Heidegger, why did it resonate with Japanese intellectuals so much around this time?
Yes. You know, in a way, it's still the case that philosophers in Japan, academic philosophers in the universities, are almost totally engrossed with Greco-European philosophies. In Japanese philosophy departments, almost all of the philosophy, almost all of the tetsugaku that is taught, that is learned by the students, is what we call, in general, Western philosophy. In the 1880s, say after Imperial Tokyo University was established, Chinese and Indian philosophies were kind of recognized on the fringes as forms of tetsugaku, or forms of philosophy, but they were eventually banished from the philosophy departments, from the philosophy seminars, from what they called junsei tetsugaku, pure philosophy, which was solely Greco-European philosophy. So that was, I guess, one way that the academics have of handling this immense amount of material that was being imported into Japan since its since Japan's reopened much more to the West after the Meiji Restoration. And so there were, in very general terms, a couple of features, I think, that were important. First, there's what I think of as a kind of shock of the new that came with all of the Western imports into Japan starting in the 1870s. Not only material objects, of course, and technological things such as locomotives, but ideas, these ideas that were conveyed by the thousands of nouns that the Japanese were importing. So this shock of the new came in the form of concepts such as the individual, or human rights, or even to a certain extent a way to conceptualize things such as pure experience. So there's the shock of the new, and the shock of the new is also occurring in an age of colonization. And so Japan, politically, socially, is confronting European empires and American empires across the globe. And they are contending with defining themselves over against the European powers, and also to a certain extent protecting themselves from European colonization. And this is the part of the background of the particular intellectuals who are also becoming intrigued with the West. So starting, there were some who began to teach European philosophy in the Japanese universities, the new institutions, in the 1890s. But by the 1920s, there were dozens of Japanese intellectuals studying in France, in Germany, in the Netherlands, and they again were intrigued by the Western reaction to them and their kind of shock of the new, of being exposed to all of these novel ideas. So by this time, I think I've forgotten what your original question was, but...
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So that explains why, at least maybe partially, the reasons why Japanese philosophers were so drawn to Western philosophy at this time. And I guess we can focus on the three figures that your volume two really discusses. So we have Watsuji Tetsuro, Tanabe Hajime, and Kuki Shuzo, who were all three of them kind of were influenced by European philosophy. And then they added, I guess you can call it a Japanese characteristic to their philosophy. They explore about ethics, human will, and relationships between human and nature. So what kind of similarities do you find in their arguments or their philosophical ideas?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing to notice is that they were, of course, schooled at first in Japan, but they all ended up in Europe in the 1920s, all three of them. And I think their times overlapped. I don't know that they had much contact among themselves. But Kuki was one of the first. Kuki was born in, I think, 1888, perhaps. Watsuji in 1889, and Tanabe was born, I believe, in 1875. So he was a bit ahead of them. And they all studied with Heidegger. They had contact with some older, more established figures at the time in German universities, such as Heinrich Rickert, who was trying to bring together social ways of knowing with more philosophical, empirical scientific ways of knowing. And these three had contact with Rickert. And also with the towering figure of Edmund Husserl, who is a founder of phenomenology. And so there are even records of letters written, say, between Tanabe and Husserl, or Tanabe and the younger Heidegger. So they have this common font of sources, these three do. And yet they go back to Japan, they start teaching what Heidegger was doing, what Husserl was doing for the first time. And they also are creative writers in themselves and develop over several decades their own philosophies. Kuki, unfortunately, died quite young. I think it was in, I don't remember, 1944, something like that. He had died, but he is somebody who was in Europe as a Japanese intellectual, and he was in Germany and in France as a very sophisticated cosmopolitan person. And yet, in the jaundiced eyes of many of those he met at the universities, he was somebody of the yellow race. And that, I'm sure, had a very deep effect on his life. And so he had to somehow personally grapple with the way that some humans treat others in a very discriminatory fashion, and yet we can all develop together. And so what Kuki is somebody who became fascinated with the notion of contingency or happenstance, or guzensei, things that just happen as they do with no adequate explanation, no way to pin down the causes of why something happens as it does. And he actually wrote the most systematic work on contingency in any language, in any philosophy. He also was a person who learned to read Latin and Greek. He wrote in French. He could write in German, and of course his native Japanese. So, by the way, there's a very interesting story about how he served as a kind of conduit for teaching Europeans about one another. When he was in Paris in the 1920s, he hired, so the story goes, Jean-Paul Sartre, who was much younger, as a tutor in language and to tell him about what was going on in French philosophy. Now, Kuki had already been in Germany and studied with Heidegger. And so the story goes that Kuki introduced Heidegger's philosophy to Sartre. And this was also revolutionary in itself. And so this was just something that happened to happen. And it's an example of the contingency, the happenstance, in German it's called the Zufall, that became such a prominent theme in his own philosophy. So he eventually tried to find an ethical turn, an ethical relevance to his philosophy of contingency. The way it works is this. Ethics is interested in behavior that we share in common. Ethics isn't just about how I behave by myself, but how I behave in common with other people. So ethics is about, for example, how moral codes, moral regulations, ethical rules are formed and developed, and whether there are more or less universal principles of behavior which should bind all of us. So ethics is general and it's universal. The more ethical something is, the more universal it can be applied. And so what do we do when we see how contingent much of our lives is? What do we do with ethics then? And so to make a very long story short, at the end of his major works on contingency, Kuki came up with not a formula, but it's a kind of imperative. It's a kind of an ethical imperative, but it isn't like a rule that we're supposed to follow as such. It's rather a kind of opportunity. And he phrased it this way: never let your encounters pass in vain. Never let your encounters pass in vain. That would mean, for example, that if you're confronted with somebody who's really mean and nasty and uncivil, if you're confronted with incivilities, you don't simply react immediately and fight against them and perhaps defend yourself, but you pause and wait a minute and find a better way to respond to that incivility than just to reject it in the person who is being nasty. This is, of course, not something that Kuki formulates in those terms. It's something that I came up with in thinking about this sort of ethical imperative, which has a lot to do with the contingencies of our life. So, of course, in your studies, you, I'm sure, have read a lot about Kuki as the philosopher of iki, this supposedly untranslatable term that has to do with aesthetic sensibility and sensitivity. And yes, Kuki does that too, but for me, he's the philosopher of contingency. So there's the other two, of course, Watsuji and Tanabe. So let's see, what can we say about Watsuji? I was most interested, Watsuji is a writer of covers vast territory. He has written about primitive Buddhism. He wrote about the history of ethics in Japan, but perhaps his most important work came out actually in three volumes, starting in about 1935 to 49, were what he calls ethics, Rinrigaku. Now, Rinri is a very old word, Chinese word, but Rinrigaku is one of these imports from the West, the study of how we live together. And the amazing thing about Watsuji for me was how he took an ordinary Japanese word, and he showed how that word could display his entire philosophy. And that word is the word that translates human being, ningen. So if we look at the two kanji, the two Chinese characters that compose this compound, ningen, we see that the first is just a word that roughly refers to humans, individual or in groups or whatever. And the second, this gen, is also, as you know, by itself read aida, or between, or perhaps an interval, or it's read sometimes as ma, something that opens up a space. And so the word ningen, Watsuji says, tells us an awful lot about what human beings are. They are, in a sense, inter-beings, I-N-T-E-R, beings. They are beings together. We are human by being together. We are essentially together from the beginning. We are not simply individual persons, and this shows up in the very conception of ningen. So the ethics of ningen is the ethics of how we actually do and how we should live in relationships with one another, and so. That's a fascinating idea to me, and it goes far beyond the usual cliche that Japanese societies, like some other East Asian societies, have a lot of group consciousness. That's a very superficial way to understand, I think, a very deep point. So that's a kind of entry into the thought of Watsuji Tetsuro. Tanabe Hajime is more complicated. I have been interested mostly in his later work, starting toward the end of the Pacific War, the Second World War, so starting about 1944. And the work he was doing at that time, when he was, the universities actually were being basically shut down. And he had been, as I said before, a philosopher who was trained in Japan and also in Europe. And he was somebody who was interested in developing a philosophy of, we could call it, of mediation. Of how we how we necessarily build social structures which let us negotiate not only our say commercial business but our very lives with one another. And so he developed what he called a logic of species. Now he used a biological term here, but he said in the case of human beings, each society is a kind of species, and it's an interspecies too. So, Tanabe is working out all of this, all the intricate details of this logic of species, and part of that is his notion of the nation state as a kind of forum and an authority, which is the final voice in how we negotiate and how we mediate our problems. And of course, then if we look, especially look today back at the Japanese nation state of the time, it was engaged in its own colonialism. And of course, by 1944, in World War. And so Watsuji's rude awakening was how impotent his logic of species was to deal with the authoritarian power of the Japanese state. And he was seeing his own students being shipped away to other countries to fight and lose their lives, supposedly to protect to protect Japan and save Japan and protect the emperor. And so this came as a rude awakening, perhaps over 1 or 2 years, but it showed the kind of impotence of an academic philosophy to meet the political social challenges of the time. And so he underwent a very deep kind of conversion, what he calls he drew the word from the Greeks, metanoia, a change of heart. And he developed a philosophy that he called metanoesis, again, coming up with a new version of an old Greek word. And this metanoetic philosophy showed what he came to experience as the limit of reasoning, the limit of rationality. And so where do we turn then as philosophers if we say that rationality is not going to provide us with everything that we needed, everything that we had hoped for? We don't want to become irrational. On the other hand, to what do we turn? And so Tanabe himself found sustenance in forms of true Pure Land Buddhism, which, by the way, one of his students introduced him to. But at the same time, he realized he couldn't just communicate a new version of true Pure Land Buddhism to people who had no access to that, no familiarity with it. And so he writes this philosophy of metanoetics from this point of view that's a change of heart. And it also has to do with the way that we sometimes need to submit to more than ourselves, and yet obviously a danger in that is submitting to an authoritarian power. And so Tanabe is somebody who himself is caught between and trying to negotiate the difference. He's trying to teach us the difference between, give us the space between simply submitting to things which could turn out to be quite pernicious, quite dangerous, on the one hand, and resisting them selfishly from the beginning. So what's in between those two extremes? That's his philosophical problem in this era, and then at the end of the war. So that's what—that's kind of a nutshell of how I understand these three figures.
And I have one last very big question for you, which is the one that you explored in toward the end of this volume. So from the thoughts of these three philosophers, we can kind of see their shared concern for human relations, for culture, Japanese culture in particular, and for perhaps the position of Japan as a race, as a nation state within this world that was about to be taken over by Western forces. And somehow, as you also mentioned, Zen Buddhism played a sort of important part in the exploration of Japan's cultural identity, especially around this time period when nationalism was at rise, and these philosophers were trying to figure out who they were, what they were, and what their purposes was. You also kind of reflected on their discussion about the relationship between human and nature. So what, I guess to integrate the philosophy of these three figures and of course your own reflections, what do you see as that can be, let me rephrase that, what do you think can be said about their exploration of human nature and nature, and then how does that situate within the context of their search for modernity in the 1930s, 40s in Japan?
That's a very big question with a lot of angles to it. And so I'll just make a brief comment about the last part first, the backdrop of modernity, which comes about through the confrontation with Western powers. Basically, one of the, and to remind us all of one of the controversial angles of some of the Japanese philosophers, particularly the so-called Kyoto school, and some other intellectuals. As you know, in the early 1940s, there were a number of symposia on the question of modernity and overcoming modernity. And these discussions have been wonderfully translated into English recently by Richard Kauffman. And Nishida himself, nor any of the other three that we've talked about so far, participated in these discussions, but students of Nishida did, in particular Nishitani Keiji. And if you read these discussions, they're very wide-ranging, and there are nationalists promoting the superiority of the Japanese racially, biologically, literally. And there are people who are on the opposite side. Shimomura Teitaru was one of the, on the opposite side. But you see very little discussion of what I think the biggest issue is, and that is colonization. Of course, Japan is engaged in its own colonizing. I mean, it started colonizing Korea and at the beginning of the 1900s, and then you saw what after Manchuria and Japan and Manchuria and say the Philippines, what's now Vietnam, it's in the process of colonizing. And these intellectual figures know this. They don't know as much as certainly as much as we know today about it. But modernization is also about colonization, I think. And there are many ways of colonizing. There's cultural colonization. There's cultural nationalism as well as military nationalism. And so the cultural nationalism in Japan is one aspect of Zen Buddhism, certainly not the only aspect. But it begins in the late 1800s, after, say, Japan is invited to present its its culture at the World's Fair, the World Parliament of Religions. This is a parliament of religions. A parliament is a ruling house. A parliament is an idea where different elements can come together and compete, as it were, show their best. And in the world of Parliament of Religions, we have a view of religion as a way of salvation. And we have a number of Western religions, Christian religions among them, of which each says, we are the only true religion. We are the only way of salvation. And so the Buddhists and the Zen Buddhists, Shakusoin and others who come to the World Parliament of Religions are engaging with their audiences in this kind of venue. And they are, in a certain sense, forced to be missionaries, not really proselytizing or forcing conversions as such, but presenting what is different and what is best about their so-called religion. The whole notion of religion, of course, is only as shukyo, an old word given new meaning in the 1870s. That's a modern European concept in Japan, shukyo. So this is sort of the backdrop of what was going on between Zen institutions and the challenge of cultural nationalism. It was seen as a kind of challenge at the time, how best to let others know who and what we are and were. Now, what does that have to do with human nature? Well, there's the part, first, I suppose, has to do with human nature in that human beings are competitive and can engage in forms of nationalism. But Zen practice itself, in all of its different forms through the centuries, can be seen as, in another phrase, it can be encapsulated in another phrase that Nishitani Keiji used a lot. And that is the phrase Koji Kyūmei, or self-investigation. So he presented Zen as a way to investigate oneself in all of the facets of life, not just as an individual, but in a life which touches and is touched by all others, to investigate that deeply through meditative practices. And that's what Zen is for Nishitani Keiji, and was the most pertinent, the most relevant meaning of Zen Buddhism for me personally, this self-investigation. What Nishitani did was he related this Koji Kyūmei as a form of self-investigation, self-examination, to its analogs in Western philosophy, starting with Socrates, who said the unexamined life is not worth living, or St. Augustine, or Pascal, or Descartes, who were also engaged in their own ways of self-investigation. And this is something that is across the board human. It is a human in a global activity. And so that's, I think, a deeper root of Zen Buddhism that presents its humanizing, I think, a little differently than the cultural nationalism part. Now, one last word, and that is that recently, I'm not sure why, but how it happened, but I've become very interested in the non-human, in other animals, and in nature, because, of course, we're faced with enormous ecological crisis today. And every philosopher has to deal with that as well. And it's curious to me that the word nature, today in Japanese as well, shizen, typically means what is non-human. Nature is the mountains and the grass and the rivers and the trees and other animals, but not really the human. We are outside of that or above it or separate from it. And so what is the relation between the human and the non-human, or human and nature? I think this is a kind of dichotomy which is, it can be quite dangerous. So what I have learned through my engagement with Japanese philosophy and with anthropologists and with people who study animal behavior is that human beings have affected nature for eons, for millennia. It isn't the case, as we're told, with the so-called Anthropocene era, that only now is nature no longer to go on as it is. It's affected by human beings. Nature has always been affected by human beings and other animals as long as they've been around. And so to sum it up for me, what I've learned is that it is ways of expressing that we are part and parcel of nature, and nature is part and parcel of us. And I think that has tremendous relevance for dealing with the ecological crisis that we face today.
That's very illuminating, and certainly leaves a lot for us to think about and to read about. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for this very enlightening conversation.
Thank you. It's been I've enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
Thank you. Me too. Listeners, to learn more about early modern Japanese philosophy and beyond, make sure you check out this series, Japanese Philosophy in the Making by Dr. John Morado. I should also mention that this series is edited by our other wonderful co-host, Dr. Takeshi Morisato. This is Jingyi from New Books in Japanese Studies. Stay tuned for our next episode. Until then, goodbye.